Let's go.
Live from the Dan Kosky Center for the Study of Languages on Asylum Hill, I'm Kyone Wolf, and last night I was in a bar, and this Klingon guy walks up, and he says, "Are you from Tennessee? Because you're the only 10 I see." And I told him, "Katubalikatubakaku." Unfortunately, that turns out to mean there are 12 rabbits in my pants. Today on the show, dying languages and newly constructed ones. But first, a long-form chat with Environment Commissioner Dan Esty. And now, Jabba the Hutt called him a total power rundy sloy, Colin McEnroe.
That's right. Later in the show today, we will be talking about dying languages, a specific dying language, and also the construction of new languages for fictional worlds. But first, though, we did want to talk to Dan Esty. Dan Esty is a much celebrated writer and educator on environmental issues, and he's now the Commissioner of Environment and Energy here in Connecticut. It's been an interesting few months, and as he faces the learning curve of public office, although not your first time in public office. You worked with the EPA and the Bush administration. But let's just sort of begin, there's all kinds of things that have come up that I'm sure you want to talk about. But let's begin with your philosophy, because you come in, you know, with a series of books that you've written. You come in with the reputation of being a business-friendly environmentalist. And explain what does that mean for you as in this job?
So I think let me start by saying I have suddenly come to realize that in this job, I am having to relearn a lot. Mm-hmm. So for a guy who was a professor for the last 18 years, suddenly I'm a student again. Mm-hmm. And I've gotten some things wrong. But the core approach, as you say, is to think hard about where and how we're going to make environmental progress going forward. Mm-hmm. And for most of the last 30, maybe even 40 years, people have thought the critical point of intervention to drive us toward cleaner water, safer chemical use, better air for breathing, has been regulation, and that the key point of leverage is government. Mm-hmm. And what I have come to conclude after 20 years of working in this arena is that government's really important, but there's a great deal that can be done with a focus on business as a key point of leverage. And that if you can get business to step up and solve problems, create new technologies, you can move down the field much more quickly than if you rely on government regulation alone.
So does that mean you kind of have to have two hats? I mean, you're going to have even more than two hats in this job in some ways because of the energy component. But are you sometimes putting on your kind of sheriff hat and doing the regulation and the intervention and then sometimes putting on more your business guy hat and doing the partnership model? And if so, what's the trigger point? At what point does a business trigger the switching to the sheriff hat?
So really, I would say there's actually three different hats. Mm-hmm. One hat, and the easiest one maybe to talk about, is environmental steward hat, mm-hmm. where we're taking care of our parks, our forests, our wildlife preserves, Long Island Sound. And that's really a management job of trying to make sure that these resources are preserved and we have access for the public. But you're right. Hat number two is regulator. And when in our department we've got laws to enforce, I have to step up and with the staff make sure we've got a sound scientific basis for what we're doing and a proper legal framework and go after people who are not meeting the standards that have been set. And that's part of the job every week. And it does require me to be tough on companies. And I am happy to do that. That's what the requirements are. And frankly, the key to the alternative approach that I want, which is really to engage business in the creative process of finding new ways to move us forward, being innovative, the only way you get the running room for that process is to ensure that everyone else is obeying the law. So the third job, as you say, is trying to really focus on innovation, trying to get companies to solve the problems we have. This is particularly important in the arena of clean energy, where we have a really serious challenge in front of us. We've got a fossil fuel-based economy that creates lots of problems, from local air pollution to consumption of water to greenhouse gas emissions. And the goal is really to try and drive a creative process that gets us alternatives that are both cleaner and cheaper going forward.
You know, your immediate or nearly immediate predecessor, Regina McCarthy, had a terrific reputation. And I think everybody in the state who cared about the environment thought pretty highly of her. But that her tenure was preceded by the Roland years. And in the Roland years, the DEP in some ways got a pretty bad reputation. There was an article I'm sure you've seen from 2004 in E! Magazine, an environmental magazine. The headline, I think, was the Department of Environmental Corruption. There were questions about whether regulations were being enforced at all. The top lawyer for the department was eventually fired in the midst of a kind of controversial lawsuit in which her silence appeared to be, after having attempted to be a whistleblower, her silence seemed to be negotiated from a series of settlements. There were questions, once again, about whether friends of the administration could have environmental issues fixed by a guy in the department, sometimes known as Vito the Fixer. And so I guess some people might be looking at that and saying, I wonder if we really had this 30 years of enforcement that you're talking about. You know, has Connecticut been so by the book with environmental regulations that it's time for a new vision? Or do we still really kind of need to see what it's like when we really go by the book and do standard old-fashioned, old-school environmental protection?
Well, there certainly was a bad moment there where Vito the Fixer was active, and I think people did not have a confidence that the laws were being carried out in an even-handed way that was above and beyond politics. Mm. I think you've seen over the last 5-6 years a quite steady enforcement of the law in a neutral way that takes seriously the framework of law that we have and good science as the starting point for where people are called to account for actions that are not within the boundaries. So I do think we are in a pretty good place in that regard. But let me also say that I think one of the other lessons is that even as we insist on people meeting standards, we've got to find ways to do that that are more effective and efficient. Right now, the process takes too long. It's too slow. A lot of the current framework of law is around giving people permits. But if people don't know what they're asked to do because it takes them 18 months to get a permit, that's not a good thing. So we do need to find ways to be tough-minded, enforce the law, but also to do it in a way that's efficient and fast.
You know, I think I hear this from everybody, that the permitting process takes too long in Connecticut. I don't think there's anybody who disagrees with that. But beyond that, there are some questions about whether we have the right regulations, whether we require the right permits, how much of that needs to be reformed and streamlined. I'm sure you saw the article in the Connecticut Mirror where Carl Wagoner, who's the chairman of the Council on Environmental Quality, he kind of questioned whether or not Connecticut is too strict, too tough, too limiting environmentally, granting the fact that the permitting process takes a long time and probably is going to continue to take a long time if you have to have staff cutbacks, because that's kind of a big part of it. What was your response to what he was saying? Because he seemed to be saying, hold on, let's not overhaul a series of environmental regulations that are basically sound and work and good and aren't out of line with national standards.
So, Colin, I think you're exactly right. I have little problem with the environmental goals that our law reflects, and I think the regulations in most cases are quite carefully crafted to meet appropriate standards to drive us in the right direction. But I do think the end point is not the only thing that matters. The process for getting there is important, and I think we have been slow and burdensome, and we need to be better in that regard. So I think Carl Wagoner made a good point in arguing that the problem is not fundamentally the direction we're going or the standards that people are being held to, but how they are being held to account to those standards. So I think we can maintain very high environmental standards, a match to the best of the standards across the country, but do so in a more efficient way that is less burdensome on the regulated community, but is also ensuring that we get protection for the air, the water, and the land.
Well, let's talk about a few specific cases that have troubled some people. I'm already seeing a call on the board. 860-275-7266 is our number, by the way, about the so-called Haddam land swap. Now, this was a case where not that people didn't object to the way you got involved. They objected to the way you didn't get involved. We're talking about the swapping of a relatively small sort of portion of environmentally protected land along the Connecticut River for a slightly larger forested part elsewhere. There are a lot of people who felt that swap never should have happened, in that land along the river was under a restrictive deed. It had been sold to the state for environmentally protective purposes, and that game shouldn't have been changed, and they wanted you to do something. And as you know, just from going around the state, they're still mad at you.
But there's a few people that are mad. I think most people understand this is not the biggest issue in the world. Mm-hmm. And frankly, let's be honest. The process that was followed in this case was not a good one. The legislature intervened and sort of circumvented the usual review, the usual analysis, and kind of dictated an outcome. And, you know, it was not how I would have liked to have it done, but I wasn't asked. I mean, it was really it was up to the legislature to choose how to unfold the process, and they chose a particular path. What I was asked was a fairly narrow question by Governor Malloy. Hmm. Is this swap such an environmental bad thing that it's worth vetoing a whole package of land deals? Because it was this and 11 others that would have gone down at once. And frankly, you know, the facts were it was not just a little bit more land. It was five times as much land adjacent to a state forest. And frankly, the land that the state was giving up had groundwater contamination that we were not in a position to address, which a new landowner might well have to take account of. And I guess on balance, and I get my letter to the governor on this is out in the open, I said it wasn't clear. It wasn't obvious that it was a good deal. It wasn't obvious it was a bad deal. And on that basis, the governor chose not to veto the whole package. So, you know, would I wish to have future land exchanges done in a more thoughtful way following the process? Absolutely. But was this, you know, the biggest environmental deal in the, of the year? I really don't think so.
Some people would say, well, this was a case where you had not only landowners and citizens of the area screaming for you to intervene. You even had some legislators, and Ed Meyer was trying to get you involved.
But let's say it was actually screaming on both sides.
Screaming on both sides. But
and really, if you looked closely, probably a little louder screaming in favor among local officials, a split among the legislators, and a split among the DEEP former commissioners, the DEP former commissioners. My predecessor immediately had said, not a good deal. The one before that had said, yeah, maybe this is the thing to do. So I felt it was not you know, a top-tier issue.
On the other hand, some people would say, well, you know, down the road, a few weeks or months, we had this CLNP case about smart meters where you did intervene. You perhaps with fewer people clamoring for it, you did intervene. The utility regulator had prepared a ruling after taking testimony. And then you were criticized for sort of jumping in and saying, hold on, stop it. I want to suspend that. I want to look at the whole policy structure underneath this ruling. And so I think a lot of people would say, well, how come he didn't want to intervene when people were asking him to intervene in the Haddam land swap? But he did intervene when, as far as we could tell, nobody was asking him.
Well, no, actually, it's not true that no one was asking. The new energy law that we had, Public Act 1180, actually positively mandated that the kind of a fundamental aspect of the new approach to energy going forward, and this is what the governor had asked for, the legislature agreed to, was that before making energy policy through the back door of public utility control, that we do it through a front door of an energy policy process. And the legislature had mandated that process, and all I asked for, frankly, without knowing what the outcome was going to be of that public utility regulatory authority decision, I didn't know which way it was going to go, but I said, whatever way it's going to go, this is not what the legislature asked us to do. What they asked us to do is to lay out a thoughtful, systematic approach to energy efficiency, including smart meters, and I said, let's hold off on a regulatory decision until we've got the policy framework in place.
Although I think it kicked another tripwire too, which is, you know, we're in a new era where the formerly freestanding DPUC is now the PURA. It's under your control, sort of, but there's also this desire that it be somehow or other independent. So I think some people were looking at that and going, well, hold on, is SD going to be jumping in?
No, you are absolutely right. And frankly, you know, we stumbled on that. And we are really trying to feel our way forward, get clear on how this structure works with the commitment that we have made through this legislation to get a policy framework in place first and build on top of it a regulatory decision process. So some people say, in fact, maybe you just said, that the new PURA is under me in the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection. What I like to say, no, I'm under them, by which I mean that I lay out the policy framework with my new Energy and Technology Policy Bureau. And from that framework, then regulatory decisions go forward without intervention by me or anyone else in the department. Well, there is a kind of independence at that point.
So, and let me make sure I understand this. So in the future, let's say Jack Bykoski has another ruling. But what if you look at that and you say, well, wait a minute, that's not the policy framework we laid out. You're not following the policy framework we laid out. Are you then on the phone to him? Are you then writing letters? How does that work?
Well, first of all, the rest of the department outside of the PURA has the right, like any other petitioner, to offer comment in the course of a rate case or a rate review. So we'd certainly offer up our thinking as to what we believe the policy would call for in a particular case. But the three directors of the PURA are independent. They can make decisions within what I hope is the framework we provided, but they have the ability to make a decision that we are not in a position to second guess.
Let me ask you about another case that you've gotten involved with, and that's in Milford, where there's a site that seems to have been contaminated by the makers of Bic pens. This is a long-running case within the DEP. There seemed to be, or DEEP, both really, there seemed to be kind of a moment where maybe they were going to go forward with some hardcore litigation on this. You've kind of jumped in and tried to put together some kind of framework for a settlement on this. This again has kind of raised some eyebrows, and there's some stakeholders down there. A lawyer for adjacent landholders are saying, "Well, what's SD doing now?" And this seems a little irregular, and we're a little concerned.
Stop you there, though. It's not irregular.
Okay.
There's a longstanding, you know, both legal foundation for and active practice of the commissioners trying to move cases forward and bring them to resolution. You know, the choice of litigation for years, and this case has already been going 7 years, is time-consuming, resource-consuming, and frankly, in many respects, not good for any of the parties. So what I did was totally within the normal bounds. Although I have to tell you, I'm learning that everything I do now gets scrutinized in ways that I wouldn't have imagined. And so I've had to become much more careful. And in that regard, I have to say that there's limits to what we can talk about today, because it's a pending legal action, and one where, you know, all I can say really is that we will absolutely guarantee that the citizens of Connecticut's right to careful environmental protection, ecological guarding of core resources, and public health protection will be the decision point that we focus on from the deep point of view.
Although, once again, I know there's things you can't comment on, but generally speaking, sometimes people look at what you just said and they say, well, when a case has been going on for 7 or 8 years, is it going on for 7 or 8 years because the party that you're trying to deal with has been dragging its feet and filing motions and not producing evidence when asked for and being uncooperative? Is that a way that you win? You know, you can, if you stall long enough, you'll get deep to the table for some kind of negotiation instead of a prosecution.
No, in fact, what I would argue is we would only move this to a resolution on a basis that guarantees the citizens of Connecticut an outcome that is protective of public health. And I would do it because I might get the chance to deliver that good outcome sooner than if we go on with litigation for years into the future. So I do think there's a trade-off here. And I think there's a broader point, Colin, that it's worth talking about. And that is that I think in environmental protection in recent years, we have not understood that speed matters. Mm-hmm. To get a good answer now is better than to get a perfect answer 8 years from now, in the meantime having exposed people to a harm. So I am very eager to move things forward in a way that is protective and, frankly, takes account of the fact that efficiency and speed are virtues. And we do need to take that on board in how we deliver environmental protection. And, frankly, it's something that the business community is asking for as well. And we're in a competitive world. We've got to ensure that how we carry out our environmental protection efforts is not perceived as slow and burdensome or not well-founded in the law and science.
You know, you said, I think, at the beginning of the conversation that the environmental protection and regulation part of it is still something that has to be thought about and dealt with, I think you said, every week at DEP. And for people who are a little jumpy about DNSD right now, and they look at Haddam and they look at Milford and they look at CLNP, and they add up in their heads whatever they're going to add up in their heads, whether it seems logical or fair to you or not. Are there some things that you can point to allay their concern and say, okay, here's some instances where I, Dan Esty, am putting on my sheriff hat. Nobody's crossing the line. And if they do, they're going to get whacked down, or maybe they already have gotten whacked down. Is there stuff that people don't know about that shows that side of you?
Yeah, there's lots of stuff going on behind the scenes. But as you know, when you're the sheriff, you don't pull the trigger out in front of the crowd. Mm-hmm. You got to do it carefully and in a way that makes sense from the public point of view. So it's hard to talk about a lot of the cases where we are cracking down hard on people because they are going on behind the scenes according to appropriate legal process. The other thing, you know, Colin, I want to be honest about is I've made mistakes. Mm-hmm. I have not communicated in a way that really, I think, tells the story in a full or rounded way. And I do take seriously all the aspects of the job we've talked about. And I think I haven't been articulate in how to make the public understand that in every case. So I know I've got a lot to learn here, and I think I'm making some progress, but still have more to learn.
One thing that you did try to be articulate about going in was the ethical standard that you were going to hold yourself to, which was really, in a lot of ways, a higher standard, a higher setting of the bar than we typically see for Connecticut public officials. Paradoxically, over the last few months, you find yourself asking a lot of questions and becoming the absolute favorite subject of John Linder, the investigative reporter for The Current, about various kinds of conflicts of interest and how they affect you and speaking fees you've received and prior business associations you've had with people that you may or may not be making regulatory decisions about and campaign contributions to your wife's congressional campaign. And I don't know, if there's an overarching way. I'm sure you don't want to go point by point through all this stuff, but is there an overarching way we can talk about this? I mean, what have you learned from all that? And what do you think is being said unfairly about all that?
Well, let's start with what's fair. Right. I think it's fair for people to ask, you know, who is this guy? Where's he come from? What's he done? Mm-hmm. Who's he worked for in the past? And I've tried to now lay that all out. And I think it's, you know, I'm completely committed, as you pointed out, to trying to establish a very high standard for not having a conflict of interest and being open about what my past business associations have been, where they've been significant and where they haven't. And I think I've now done that, and I will be filing, if not today, then tomorrow, a request for an advisory ethics opinion, laying out all that I've done and getting the official process to say whether I've done the right thing or not. And if I haven't done all that I need to do, I'll do more. So I really am committed to meeting the standard of the law and going beyond where appropriate.
You know, I know that you thought, because you called me up and told me the column I wrote about all this stuff early on was unfair. But I think there are some people who might look at all of your prior associations, and you really have been a leader in this idea of partnership between the environmental movement and business. And you've written these books, including this Green to Gold book, which has attracted a lot of admiration from the business community. And you've been a consultant to these various businesses, including ones active in the state. And you said you'd recuse yourself from all that. There's some people who might look at all that, and you've been a well-paid speaker over the last 5 years. And some people would say, you know, there's just no way he can do it. You know, he's got so many associations with all these businesses that are going to be players in this market of regulation protection and going forward with environmental goals. How can he possibly he's got too much baggage.
So let's dig into that, because that's again, it's a fair question. So there are already a couple of cases, but only a couple, where I have had to say that case I'm not working on because I had a direct relationship with a company that's involved. So it's delegated, you know, not to some far-flung person, but to a very talented deputy commissioner who's in a position to make the hard choices and carry out the sheriff role if it's that kind of a situation, which in several cases it is. So I am very confident that where I've recused myself, we have absolutely top-tier decision-makers that step in to make the choices. So it's not as though if I step out because I'm recused, that suddenly the company gets to run wild. Not at all. They're simply held to account in front of a different decision maker, but again, very talented people. And I think beyond that, you know, what I would argue is that the sheriff role, as you've identified, is only one of my three roles. And I would argue that the real opportunity for Connecticut stands in engaging the business community and positioning a set of incentives that help them guide their own activities towards better environmental performance and, frankly, drives a process of innovation, which Connecticut has historically been very good at. We've been leaders on things like fuel cells and a number of other aspects of clean energy. And that's where I think the governor really wants us to go, and that's where I'm committed to go, is to creating a policy framework, particularly a framework of economic incentives. And we've set up a green bank, and we've set up a whole set of new zero emissions renewable energy credits, which is very pathbreaking, that I think is going to drive lots of finance, lots of capital into solving particularly the clean energy problem, the need for more energy efficiency at every level, including state buildings. You probably know we've just launched an initiative in that regard. Some of our state buildings are among the least well constructed, very poor from a conservation point of view. But then I want to go beyond that to homes, not just houses, but apartments, condos, senior living centers, and of course to commercial and industrial enterprises as well. And all of that helps bring down the price that people pay, lowers the energy burden all of us face, and from the business point of view will make us more competitive. And likewise, we want to drive capital into renewable power. We're in the midst in this society of a transition. I don't know whether it's 10 or 20 years or 30 or 40 years, but to a beyond the fossil fuel era. And I want Connecticut to play a leadership role in that.
We're talking to Dan Estey, our fairly new commissioner of environment and energy protection. Last set of questions here. You know, you said earlier in the interview you think you've made some mistakes and maybe haven't communicated everything perfectly. I think in one article I read you even referred to your tone in one letter as jerkish.
That was referring to my the famous letter on smart meters, which, you know, in retrospect, the language was just flat out wrong.
No, I like jerkish was better.
Well, I mean, jerkish
is one of the dying languages we're going to be talking about in the next segment is jerkish.
You know, which is a country near Turkish, right?
Right. But I'm just sort of wondering, okay, so you're taking on, you know, some of the blame or whatever we want to call it for that. Do you think the press has been unfair? Do you think John Linder he's been telling a bunch of articles about you?
You know, I have come to appreciate again, and I said earlier, I'm you know, shifted roles from professor to student here. Mm-hmm. And I'm in a very different realm than I was sitting as a professor at Yale or even out there commenting on issues of the day as a policy guy or trying to help companies step up. And, you know, that's a whole other area of my work where I've really tried to make it clear to companies that by taking environment and sustainability seriously, it's not just a burden, not just regulations to follow, cost to bear, risk to manage, but there's an opportunity to actually save money and to solve their own customers' problems and become kind of solution providers and to make money doing that, to better engage with their customers. So I think I get that I'm in a different realm now, and I've got to learn how to play in that domain and understand that the scrutiny that is there is much greater than I'm used to. And so I'm learning, and you're helping me learn, Colin. You've written some stuff that
I'm sure you found me very helpful.
I'm taking on board.
The last question. Your wife is running for Congress. She's running against the Speaker of the House, among other people, in what will be a primary campaign, we assume. He's raised a hell of a lot of money already, we just found out, and from all kinds of different sources. She's got to raise money, too. How are you going to handle that? She's going to have to raise money from all kinds of, I assume, business sources and stuff like that.
So we've looked carefully at the laws here and the requirements. And it is clear that she is able to raise money from a variety of sources. It's a federal office she's running for. I'm a state official. But in order to ensure that the appearances as well as the legal requirements are met, I have indicated that I will not raise any money from anyone with business interests in the state of Connecticut that I might regulate. So I'm going to absolutely steer clear of that. And she's out there doing this on her own. Of course, she has an extraordinary background. She's been a state representative, worked for years at the local level, and I think has a very solid foundation of relationships on her own. So she doesn't need me. You know, I'll call some friends and family outside the state and try to help her. She's a great person. I think she'd be a great representative.
All right, Dan Estes, it's been great visiting with you. I hope you come back in a few months. We'll do a checkup, see how we're both doing.
I'd welcome a chance.
All right, thanks for joining us. When we come back, we're going to be talking about dying languages and a little bit later even about languages being created to fill universes that don't really exist. All things ain't what they used to be now. Where did all the blue skies go? Poison is the wind that blows from the north.
Koi kelles pook load, koi poop back poo. Yuck bo mafo jesu me, say machu me boo.
That would be not a dying language, but I don't know what you call it. Maybe it is a dying language. That's actually Klingon, I believe. It's a Klingon war song. We are going to talk much more seriously, though, right now about a real language in danger of extinction. A little bit later, we will talk to the man who invented a language for the movie Avatar. Will be joining us in a little while. Right now, we're going to talk to Jonathan Bobolek. He is a professor of linguistics at the University of Connecticut. He has become concerned and invested in a language called Edelman, of which I think there are 15 or 20 speakers left in the world. Tell us a little bit about Edelman, where it's spoken and if it's spoken and what's happening to it.
Well, it is still spoken. It's spoken by, as you said, 15 or 20 speakers on the Kamchatka Peninsula in the Russian Far East. So that's if I learned first about it from Risk, if you've ever played Risk, that's where you get from Alaska to Asia or vice versa. Mm-hmm. So it's at the crossroads of continents, a lot of interesting history up there. It's an indigenous population. The peninsula was once the size of California, maybe 20,000 speakers at one point, but down to 20 or 15 now.
And explain the process now that you're undergoing. You actually have a lot of audio samples now of this language, right?
Right. So we have a number of samples. I'm part of a group that's been working since 1993 with the language. And we're preparing at the moment a multimedia documentation, so an audio-video dictionary. It'll be an online dictionary where you can click on audio clips or video clips of pieces of the language.
Now, if there are only 15 or 20 people left on this peninsula who speak the language, but there are a lot more people than that on the peninsula and who are probably ethnically kind of part of that world, is it your goal to kind of reacquaint a new generation of people there with the language that was spoken there and that's dying out?
Well, that's one of our goals. There are a number of maybe 3,000 people with ethnic Edelman ancestry, some of whom are interested in language revitalization, in learning the language again, or at least preserving it for their ancestors, keeping it in some role, say in ceremonial roles, for festivals and things like that. I'm also interested in the scientific aspect of this, documenting it for linguistics, for also for anthropology and prehistory.
Because one of the questions I guess you would have about linguistics, about language, would be how many common threads are there that run through language in terms of structure and underlying sort of basic principles. And so a language like this one, it's a fairly isolated one that doesn't share ancestry with maybe even a lot of other languages spoken nearby, would be interesting that way too.
Right, that's exactly right. So there's a hypothesis out there that there's a universal grammar, that there's a universal template or structure, universal building blocks for all languages. And it's a hypothesis. There's a lot of evidence for it. But there's some 7,000 languages spoken in the world today, and we haven't documented the vast majority of them. So testing that hypothesis, understanding the limits on variation and this burning question about whether or not languages do share a common core, depends on careful documentation and careful study of these languages from really all over the globe.
How many of those 7,000 languages are on life support?
Well, the best estimate is that 50% of them are likely to die out within the next 100 years. Some people estimate as many as 90%. So the vast majority of the world's languages are endangered.
Why is that? Why do languages die?
It's basically colonialism. Guns, germs, and steel is a good answer if you know the Jared Diamond book. We see it in North America with the indigenous languages. Actually, in connection to Dan Esty being on here, control of resources is a large part of it. Where the languages are spoken, if another culture comes in, wants control of those resources, they're economically valuable, they'll displace the indigenous populations. And that's happened all over the world, the colonial history. It's still going on right now. The BBC recently had footage of some of the last uncontacted tribes in Brazil and Peru, which are seriously threatened, again, exactly for resources, mahogany, cattle farming, this kind of stuff.
Let's actually hear. We got a little clip of Edelman. So let's hear a little bit. I believe this is a person in her 80s saying something in Edelman. You know, first of all, just to talk a little bit about intonation there, if you're listening and kind of applying your own kind of Western sensibilities to that, something kind of maybe mirthful sounding in her voice. On the other hand, if you've ever, you know, been in a culture where intonation is completely different from English, you know that's a rather dangerous road to go down. So in terms of, first of all, do you know what she's talking about?
Yeah, sure. This is part of a folk tale. And in fact, the intonation, your example is exactly right here. The intonation is not what the English intonation would suggest. It's part of a story about a wingless gosling, and this is the mother of the goose telling the wingless gosling, we're all going to fly away because otherwise we're going to freeze to death and we're going to leave you all alone. I'm warning her, if a woman in red comes, don't go with her, but if a woman in white comes, you can go with her. It plays out later in the story. And it ends.
I think Dan Esty opens a lot of his speeches with this story, actually. But go ahead.
And it ends, of course, with the brief little song of the wingless gosling sitting alone on the lake saying, mother, why have you abandoned me? I'm alone without wings. So hardly mirthful.
Well, you know, in terms of what you're trying to do, and by the way, if people have questions about this, our number, 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. You know, it's one thing to speak a language, and it's another thing to understand or be able to explain, I guess, its grammar, its underpinnings, its syntax, its subtleties. You've got 15 or 20 speakers of this language left, and once again, the language is spoken in the most northeastern part of Russia, basically, on a peninsula. Are those people able to explain explain to you how the language works, or do you have to kind of divine that from listening to it and kind of decoding it?
Well, divining that is what we do as linguists. In fact, many people are not able to, most people are not able to explain their own native language unless they've been schooled in it. And in fact, the state of grammatical knowledge in English, most people are not able to explain the grammar of English at this point. We think we have ideas about it, but people have commented recently. If you look at what pundits are saying about the use of the passive voice in English, most people without higher education in say, an English major or a linguistics course don't actually really know what the passive voice is, let alone explain why we choose one as opposed to the other. So we wouldn't expect people anywhere in the world, really, to be able to explain the intricate details of their grammar in the sense that we're looking for this universal grammar, for these universal building blocks. That's our job, to collect as much of the data as we can. And through a process of question and answer, can you say this, can you say that, which way sounds better, divine these properties and describe them.
Do the people who live on this peninsula, particularly the speakers of the language, but do they understand and endorse and cherish what you're doing, or is it, oh, here comes Jonathan again? You know, is it a goal for them to preserve their language?
We talk in this way about a goal for the culture or the people or the community, but the community is a collection of diverse individuals with different opinions. There are people there who wholeheartedly embrace this and are really glad to see this happening. There are people there who have no interest in this whatsoever and think it's a waste of everybody's time. I think you'll find that anywhere. By and large, I think most of the people in the community, at least certainly most of the speakers, are really actually very happy for the interest in the language. And as I said, there's a group of people that want to see it revived, it's being taught to younger generations. They lack a lot of material for teaching, but they're happy that we're working on this. An offshoot of what we're doing is preparing pedagogical materials for this effort.
You know, we have, I have as a friend, and we have as a friend of the show, Humphrey Tonkin, who's one of the real kind of leading lights of the world of Esperanto. And is there, in your research, you're looking at, among other things, as we said, the kind of underlying structures of language, what makes a language, and are there things that kind of work almost universally in languages? Is there an application from that to this occasionally discussed dream of having languages or a language that everybody could understand and everybody could speak?
I guess the short answer is there's pedagogical applications in the sense of, if you happen to have that dream, which I don't, but if you did happen to have that dream, you might want to look, as I gather the inventor of Navi has done, at what these patterns are that are universal, because you could put those as ingredients into your language. If you tried to create something that violated universals, that violated the natural patterns of languages, it would presumably be harder to learn. From a scientific perspective, it's actually very interesting, and people are doing studies of this sort with artificial grammars where they do this intentionally. They build in things that we hypothesize should be impossible and try to see if those are indeed harder to learn, and they do seem to be harder to learn.
All right. Let's since we're talking about, he mentioned Navi, Jonathan is going to have an opportunity to talk and ask questions to somebody who did invent a language, and it's probably not going to help anybody in any indigenous situation except on another planet. But we'll take a little break. We'll come back. We'll talk to the inventor of Navi.
Attentu la nocton de la eclipso. Incubo levigis de nocereseo.
There's an Edelman joke about what a walrus and the president of Tupperware have in common. Wait, apparently I'm not allowed to tell it. Today's show was produced by Patrick Scahill and me, with help from Alyssa Baylor and Andrew Kufta. The part of Bill Curry was played by Sigourney Weaver. On tomorrow's show, New Yorker cartoonist Roz Chast. And now, back to Colin.
So we've been talking to Jonathan Bobulick, who's a professor of linguistics at the University of Connecticut and who's been studying and working to analyze and preserve a real-life language that's very much in danger on a peninsula in Russia. Now joining us is somebody who actually created a language where none existed. And I don't know how much hope it brings to the world, but maybe some. Paul Frommer is Professor Emeritus of Clinical Management Communication at USC Marshall School of Business. And he was brought in to make sure that there was a language for the planet that's depicted in Avatar. First of all, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Colin. Nice to be here.
And explain what were you tasked with doing, as they say? What did they ask you to do?
Well, James Cameron pretty much wanted a complete language for the planet of Pandora. I mean, so much detail went into creation of that world that he didn't want to skimp on the language. And, of course, since Klingon came into the world, you can't just have Guguwawa as an alien language. It has to be something with structure, which actually holds up to scrutiny. So that's what I had to do.
And maybe even preceding Klingon, I know that Tolkien was rather meticulous about making sure that Elvish at least worked to a certain degree or was translatable, at least by him. And so let's hear, we're going to hear a little bit of Na'vi right now. So this is a little clip from the movie.
Ewayueng lut'ana tekaung. Tau tu te serau te folkeru tratis kiva piate fetseng yerin matsute iterong loa ate yuitan oengenga glik e ohe alaski o matika yaru kite sevi fesweretti ngal pelun molunge fetsenge o elpots pemeyang saok zau aungi ate ewa polt eoe sanzene ke onil teranyu ke zivo fetseng fahewa ke wong.
And I think that needs no translation. That's actually not from the movie. That's like somebody, I think, who's learned to speak Na'vi.
That's kind of a compilation of different lines from the movie, right?
So, you know, I want to ask both you and Jonathan this question. First of all, I'll start with you, though, Paul. I'm hearing sounds there that an English speaker would not necessarily easily emit. Sure. So was one of your goals there to kind of create some sounds that sounded different and sounded interplanetary?
Well, sure. I mean, there's no reason to think that a language, especially a language on another planet, would sound like English. So really the first step is to determine the sound system of the language, what linguists refer to as the phonetics and phonology of the language, what sounds go into the language, what sounds are not found in the language, how sounds come together, you know, what sort of combinations of sounds exist, how sounds can change into other sounds depending upon position in the word and things like that. So Na'vi has some interesting sounds. I think that the sounds that people have focused on most are what we call ejectives, which sound kind of like n, u, and a. They're sort of popping sounds which are produced with a different airstream mechanism. Air doesn't come from the lungs but from the glottis. But these sounds are found in various human languages.
Yeah, among the Mittelmann, I might add, there were ejectives in the clip we heard from Mittelmann as well.
Yeah, I was wondering about that, too. Yeah. So, Jonathan, maybe you could just say, in terms of Edelman, there are, once again, are noises I heard there that I wouldn't easily pronounce, although some of them almost sounded like a Scottish burr or something. Mm-hmm. But so among the Edelman, the people who speak that language, they use different parts of, I guess, their mouth and air system to make sounds.
Well, it's essentially the same parts. There's a limited set of articulators that we have. There's the tongue, there's the glottis, there's the velum. We all have the same mouth. This is one of the interesting things I talked about in terms of the universals of language, that at least among human languages, I can't speak to other planets, the range of sounds is constrained. Not everything you can do with your mouth is actually a sound that's used in some human language. And there are what we call implicational universals. So if a certain sound occurs in your language, then certain other sounds will also occur in your language. So if a language has ejective stops, etc., it will also have plain voiceless stops, the normal of English, but it may or may not have B, D, G, these kinds of sounds, the voiced sounds.
You know, you study languages. You got a guy here who spent 4 years inventing a language. Jonathan, I'm guessing you might have a question or two for Paul Frommer about inventing Na'vi. And so as a linguist, what do you want to know from him?
Well, I wonder, I mean, since you brought up ejectives and this you mentioned that languages on other planets may not share the same structures as English. There's no reason to assume that. But to what degree you wanted to test any of these ideas or build in things that are not just non-English, but not attested anywhere in the languages of the world. I mean, that, again, ulterior motive here might be these learning experiments to see whether or not those portions of the language would be learnable.
Right. really interesting question. I didn't deliberately build anything into the language that I thought would violate principles of universal grammar. And that was intentional because part of the working hypothesis was that human beings can learn this language and have, and in fact, of the seven characters in Avatar who speak the language to any extent, three of them are humans who have learned the language. So I wanted to make it something learnable. Now, a few months ago, I would have said that Navi completely follows the principles of universal grammar, but I recently heard a paper by a linguist at UCLA who was talking about the orders of elements in noun phrases, and Navi may violate that. So, I mean, the jury is out as to whether or not Navi is a learnable language that a kid could pick up from scratch.
Although one thing that has happened, I don't know whether this is, was anticipated or not, although you should have been able to anticipate this, is that a lot of fans and people working online and stuff like that are trying to learn the language, have tried to learn the language. And could you just talk a little bit about what you've seen happen in that realm?
Yeah, that really is for me the most remarkable thing. In other words, what's happened to Navi post-Avatar. In a nutshell, there's now a community of people all over the world who are avidly studying the language and not just studying it, but using it for genuine communication. I mean, I've heard stories of people in different parts of the world who don't share a language other than Navi and are actually being able to communicate on it. There's a website, learnnavi.org, which was started by the fans right around the time that Avatar was released. I checked this morning. It has over 500,000 posts to its forum.
That's both fascinating and disturbing. It's a little of both, although I'm sure if we didn't keep our producer, Patrick Scahill, a lot busier, he would be learning Navi as well. I feel as though, good manners requires that I learn to say something in each language. So, Jonathan, how would I greet? Can you maybe teach me quickly how to greet somebody in Edelman?
Last sunch.
Last sunch?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Close enough anyway, close enough for government. Last sunch. Yeah. And how would I greet somebody, Paul Frommer, in Navi?
Well, the word for hello is kalt-it.
That's hard. Kalt-it.
Kalt-it. It's with one of those ejective sounds. And I see you is welngatikame.
All right, and so that kalt I, so I don't finish that vowel sound at the end. It's kind of
it's a vowel we have in English, I, but what we don't have in English is that vowel at the end of a word. In fact, that was one of the things that the actors found most challenging, is to put a familiar sound in an unfamiliar place.
And Jonathan, it must be both tempting and frustrating and interesting to you to listen to Paul Frommer talk about, you know, these people jumping online and learning Navi. And I mean, it must be comparatively really, really hard to get or even imagine getting, you know, I don't know, two or three hundred young people to learn a comparable amount of Edelman.
Well, sure, but the I guess the question here, in a sense, it's not surprising because the. This is connected to one of the questions about why languages are dying out. Languages are in part a mark of identity, in-group, out-group, belonging to a particular group defined by its language. How many people are there in the world that want to declare themselves as members of the Edelman community? It's not large. It's a few thousand. How many people want to declare themselves as members of, well, whatever this community is, sci-fi fans or, you know, giant blue people or something of this sort? There seems to be a lot of people with time on their hands that want to associate with being part of this group. So it's again, it's not surprising, but it is sort of depressing how many languages the world over where there's this break between the oldest generation and the new generation, and the new generation doesn't want to self-identify as a part of this group.
Paul Frommer, obviously this must be very gratifying for you, but during that four-year time of working on this project, were there moments where you thought, I'm losing my mind here. I'm making up a language for another planet. What am I doing here?
There were certainly moments of challenge, but being connected with the film, you know, being on the set, working with the actors, talking to James Cameron, that kind of really kept me focused on what I was doing. In terms of what Jonathan just said about community, I really think that's key. There's a linguist at the University of British Columbia. Her name is Christine Shorey. She's a linguistic anthropologist who's just done a study of the Navi-speaking community. And one of the things that has emerged from the study is the fact that if people feel a sense of community, a sense of other people who want to use a language, who are into it, who are supporting each other, that's tremendously important. And then there's also the cool factor, you know.
Yeah.
If you convince kids that it's cool to do this, then they're going to do it.
Great point. Hey, we're out of time right now. Paul Frommer, thank you so much. Jonathan Bobluck, also, thanks so much. Thanks also to Dan Esty. We'll be back tomorrow with Roz Chast.
I'm Kayon Wolf Lut Akna Se Matuse Tuakse. Oh no, that wasn't a made up language. I just had a blueberry earlier and I've been trying to get the taste out of my mouth.